Last time on Canadian Spirit.
Take Harbor is a small fishing community on the south shore of Nova Scotia.
In the cockpit of Air Canada Flight 305, Captain Pierre Jean Jabinot. I don't know why I said it like that. But as they got a better look at the object, it became very clear that this was no ordinary aircraft at all. But this would be far from the only sighting of the object that night. 22 separate reports were made to the Halifax and Shag Harbor RCMP.
It is not unusual to see the Navy or aircraft dropping things into the water there, but I had never seen anything like that before.
The group began to panic, thinking that they had just witnessed a large airline crash.
Sorry, that's the angle. Oh. I just fucked up the script.
Okay, I'll try to... There was some nefarious dealings regarding the Shag Harbor UFO crash from the very beginning.
And now, part two of the Shag Harbor UFO crash.
This podcast contains language and subject matter some may find offensive. Keep out of reach of children and the elderly. This is Canadian Spirit.
Welcome back, everybody, to Canadian Spirit. I'm your host, Kelly McMillan, and sitting across from me today is... no one. That's right, Darcy couldn't make it this week. Apparently, he called me and he said he was in a real panic. He said that there was a couple of guys in black suits that came up toward the Spirit Shack and knocked on the door and demanded to be let in, and he was really scared about it. And I don't understand why. I mean, Mormons come to my door all the time and they never bother me any, so I don't know why I just didn't tell them to go away. So here we are. We are in part two of the Shag Harbor UFO crash. We're going to be wrapping things up today. I guess I'm going to be wrapping things up today because Darcy was abducted by the Mormons. But anyway, so here's a bit of a recap. I know that you heard it at the beginning of the show, but I kind of pieced that together in a hurry at the last possible moment. In October of 1967, there was a supposed unidentified flying object that crashed into the harbor in Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia. And there was a lot of confusion as to what that particular object was. There was Navy involvement not only on the part of Canada, but also in the part of the United States. The particular object was never found. However, there was a little piece of the story that we did not share with you last week, and that's only because I just came across it here this last week. Supposedly, this particular object floated under its own power to government points underwater sonar radar station, during which time there's supposed accounts. I say supposed because I don't believe that these are entirely verified accounts, but the reports claim that this object was subsequently joined by a second particular craft, and after some time, it seemed as though this other craft seemed to repair the other one, and the two took off out of the water and up into the sky. Now, there's not a lot of evidence to back this up, and in fact, some of the contacts that I have with the Halifax RCMP and the Royal Canadian Navy both say that these accounts cannot be verified, and they can't even tell us where they came from at all. So at this point, we're going to be looking at these as if they are hearsay. I was going to say heresy there, but I'm not the religious type, and I'm not about to go all Deus Vult on you guys. Sorry, listener, I'm rambling. Darcy's normally here to rein me in, but seeing as how he's not, this is kind of a... an uncensored stream of my own consciousness, so I apologize. So we're going to be starting off by looking at some similar cases from around the world. Of course, there is the most famous UFO crash of them all, which is Roswell, which is, I'm sure, an incident that even the lay person listening to this podcast is familiar with. It's a supposed UFO crash that happened outside of Roswell in Corona, New Mexico. There was a lot of reports from locals finding unusual materials around the crash site. There was a huge government cover-up and whatnot. It was later on, I believe it was in the 1980s. I don't feel like looking it up right now, so bear with me. I believe it was in the 1980s that the United States military accredited the crash to what they called Project Mogul. This was a top-secret military experiment on basically using weather balloons as a type of surveillance equipment. And according to the records of the United States government at the time, this was a complete failure. However, this is what they accredit the Roswell crash craft to being. Now, the second case that we're going to be looking at is actually from Aurora, Texas, and this is one that a lot of people don't know about. And I can kind of see why, because this particular incident happened in 1897, which is quite a while ago. The newspaper articles from a small town in Fort Worth reported that a UFO crashed into the town, taking out the local windmill, which must have been a real bitch because people really relied on those back in the day. They claimed that there was a body recovered from the wreck that was described as, quote, a creature not of this world, end quote. The groundwater in the town was also seemingly contaminated by the craft or the buried body of the pilot, but a lot of these records are kind of sketchy on that particular detail. As far as that goes, a lot of people believe that this could have been a hoax, as S.E. Hayden, the author of the newspaper article, was suspected of trying to drum up some tourism in the dying little town, which unfortunately does happen. Because, well, sometimes when you're trying to save your town, or when you're trying to stand up for something that you particularly believe in, and you don't necessarily have the journalistic integrity to keep it together, your integrity kind of goes down the toilet, so there's that. And the third case that we're going to be looking at here is what is referred to as the Height 611 UFO incident. I'm going to be spending some time on this because I found it particularly fascinating, so I'm going to actually quote from the wiki here. It's the Height 611 UFO incident refers to an alleged UFO crash in Dangorsk, Primorsky Krai, Soviet Union, and I probably butchered that, so in case there's any Russian listeners, and I know at this point there's not, so whatever. On January 29th, 1986, Height 611, also known as Mount Ivistoivska, in a hill located in the territory of the town. The incident description goes as such. A reddish ball was noticed at the inhabitants of the town around 8 p.m. on that date. Eyewitnesses say that the ball appeared to be about half the size of the moon's disk. The ball was flying parallel to the ground, and there was no sounds accompanying the flight. It was later determined that the speed of the object was approximately 15 miles per second, and that it was flying about 700 to 800 meters above the ground when the object reached Height 611. It started to descend and then crashed into the hill. All eyewitnesses but one say that there was no sound when the object reached the ground, which is kind of weird. You think that if there was an object slamming into the ground, it would make some kind of sound. Kind of reminds you of a Buddhist koan, is if a tree falls in the forest, does it make any sound? But we're not talking about trees here. Going on, the process of the descent was described differently by eyewitnesses. Some said the object fell with a flash and was not visible after that. Others claimed that it oscillated in altitude above the hill, taking flight of varying intensity as it went up and down. The light given off at the object was described by some like a forest fire and lasted for approximately 1 hour. That actually kind of reminds me of not the sound, but the visual that would accompany that, the Travis Walton case. But I'm getting off on a tangent again. Darcy, you really need to get back here because you really need to rein me in, bud. Going on, some rocks at the impact site had drops of silvery metal, which were later determined to be lead. The type of lead found at Height 611 was different from the lead to be found in the local deposits. Also, black, glassy, drop-shaped beads and mesh fragments were also found at the site. In all, approximately 70 grams of lead, 5 grams of mesh fragments, and 40 grams of beads were discovered. I don't want to know the kinky shit that aliens get up to. I don't want to hear about their beads, okay? The radiation level of the landing ground was normal. The group took pictures of the site using two different cameras, however. The film was later developed, and it was blank. The chemical analysis on these beads showed that they mostly were comprised of silicon and iron. Some of the drops contained significant amounts of zinc, bismuth, and rare earth elements. An analysis on the soil, rocks, and burnt wood taken from the landing ground were also performed. It was noted that the chemical composition was similar to the composition of similar samples taken from the site of the Tunguska event. Okay, I've heard about that. That's when there was a massive explosion and it leveled a great deal of Siberian forest. That was a long time ago. Some people think Nikola Tesla was involved, so fun fact. The mesh fragments were also analyzed. The material of which the fragments were composed of did not dissolve in strong acids and organic solvents, even when exposed to high temperatures for prolonged periods of time. One of the mesh fragments was discovered to be composed of scandium, gold, lithanium? I don't know what that is. Sodium and samarium. An analysis of another mesh fragment showed gold, silver, and nickel. After that fragment was heated in a vacuum, the analysis no longer showed these elements, however. And there's a bunch of other things that I don't even know how to pronounce, so I'm actually just going to stop quoting the wiki here. The point is that there was a UFO crash in Russia where physical evidence was involved, similar to what we're looking at in the Shag Harbor case, because there was some physical evidence left behind in the form of that yellow sulfurous foam that we were talking about. Now, the final case that we're going to be looking at is the Kecksburg UFO incident. And this occurred on December 9th, 1965, which is actually fairly close to the date that we're talking about for Shag Harbor. This happened in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, in the United States. Because, you know, there's Pennsylvanias everywhere, not just in the United States. I don't know why I said that. This happened when a fireball was reported by citizens of six U.S. states and Canada. Look at that. We actually have a connection to this one over Detroit, Michigan, and Windsor, Ontario. Astronomers said it was likely a meteor bolide, burning up in the atmosphere and descending at a very steep angle. NASA released a statement in 2005 reporting that experts had examined fragments from the area and determined that they were from a Soviet satellite. But records of their findings were lost in the 1990s. NASA responded to court orders and the Freedom of Information Act requests to search for the records. The incident gained wide notoriety in popular ufology cultures, and speculations ranging from alien craft to debris from the Soviet space probe Cosmos 96, and it's often referred to as Pennsylvania's Roswell. Now, if you guys go and look this up, if you go into Google and you type in Kecksburg UFO incident, you will be treated to a model depicting the alleged crashed object, and this thing looks like a flying butt plug. Why are aliens into butt stuff? Not that I'm judging or anything, but it's kind of weird that aliens from across the galaxy are coming here to, stick things up our asses. Anyway, I'm getting off track again. The Kecksburg UFO incident may have actually been identified. However, I'm gonna read an article by Dan Majors from the Post Gazette. It goes like this, quote, 50 years after the famous Kecksburg UFO streaked across the December sky and landed in the wooded hollow, two Westmoreland County researchers have put forward a theory that they say may explain it. The unidentified flying object that came down December 9th, 1965, they say, was a General Electric Mark II reentry vehicle that had been launched by the Air Force as a spy satellite but fell out of orbit. Authorities at the time, however, said that it was a meteorite. That official claim has been challenged, but never changed. Researchers consider the Kecksburg UFO one of the great unsolved mysteries, and people in the tiny town of Kecksburg still talk about it. Witnesses who saw it, before members of the military swooped in and took it away. Say that it was not a meteor, but a craft of some kind. The years have muddled a few recollections, but accounts at the time agree on several points. It was 4:47 p.m. when it came out of the sky from the northwest, a flaming object from over Canada, Ohio, and into the western Pennsylvania region. It appeared to be guided, changing its path and making a level descent away from residential areas and into the woods of Kecksburg. The first people on the scene said it was partly buried in the ground. It was made of metal around 10 to 12 feet long and generally shaped like an acorn or a fucking butt plug. There were strange markings on the band near the bottom that resembled hieroglyphics. The military was on the remote scene within an hour, and by 8 p.m. it was gone, hauled away on the back of an army flatbed truck. John Venture, state director of the Mutual UFO Network, did not begin earnestly looking into the Kecksburg mystery until this year, he said, because so many others already were on the case. But Shafton native Owen Eichler, who had spent decades investigating it, came to him in February with a theory and some evidence that seemed to add up, and the two joined forces. Their research, put forth in a report with the title, "Has a Top 5 UFO Case Been Solved?" suggests the vehicle was launched from Johnson Island in the Pacific 2 days earlier as part of America's top secret program for spying on the Soviet Union from space. "Of course, no one ever wanted to admit that we were spying on Russia," Mr. Venture said, offering an explanation as to why the object was taken away and never explained. The night it landed, Mr. Eichler was a 13-year-old boy in December of 1965 playing baseball in a field, when he saw the predominantly green glowing object with wisps of yellow, purple, and orange colors shoot across the sky. Hundreds of others saw the object, and thinking that it might be a plane on fire, that sounds familiar, or not knowing what to think, many called authorities. Again, sounds familiar. Kecksburg resident Stan Gordon, who would grow up to be a noted UFO researcher, was 16 and listening to a program on KDKA radio when the host began talking about calls coming in from witnesses. John Hayes was about 10 and playing football when the object landed. Despite the fact that his family lived nearby, he didn't see it. Yeah, no need to go look at the object, this craft that just fell out of the sky. No, that's boring. "But when I came to the house, my dad had the radio on and he said that something had crashed in Acme," he said. "Maybe it was a cartoon wolf with a rocket strapped to his back. Then Mom was looking out the window and said, 'It's not in Acme. It's right over there. Look at all the cars out across the hill. There was activity all over the place.'" The first people on the scene were curious neighbors, and then came the volunteer firefighters and the police. They were followed by reporters. "Then there were reports of military personnel coming in," Mr. Gordon said. What struck the residents of Kecksburg and investigators to this day was how quickly the armed military men, more than two dozen of them, arrived at the scene, taking charge and taking people away. And chasing people away, sorry. "The U.S. government claimed that they were never tracking it, which makes no sense," Mr. Venture said. "They had to be tracking it. The Canadian radar was tracking it." Yep, we're to blame. Sure, blame Canada. I think there's a song about that. Mr. Hayes saw the military men up close because they set up their command center in his family's two-story house overlooking the woods. The site offered them a view of the area as well as a working telephone. "The first thing that they did was tell my parents to send us kids to bed," Mr. Hayes said. "Well, naturally, I was excited by all the goings-on, and our bathroom was downstairs. I made a few trips to the bathroom that night." That seems like a weird detail, okay. "There were a lot of men in uniforms, and there were a lot of men in suits, and it was clear that the men in suits were in charge of everything. They were over the top of the military. They had a lot of clout." Mr. Hayes' upstairs bedroom offered a good view of authorities coming and going. "I couldn't see down into the hollow where they were at, but I did see six guys in radiation suits take a box down there," he said. "Probably a Geiger counter, if I had to venture a guess." That's my whole thing. I'm not quoting that from the article. He said, "I didn't see them bring it back out." He said a later inspection of the family's phone bill showed no evidence of the calls that were made. That's spooky. Some witnesses said the authorities warned them away from the area because of a risk of radiation from the object. Others were just ordered to leave, at gunpoint, and did so. No shit. Former Post-Gazette reporter Ernie Hoffman, 76, of Hempfield, was working the night shift in Greensburg when he and a photographer were sent to the scene. Mr. Hoffman arrived in time to see military men taking an object away on the back of a flatbed truck. But his account differs from others, from the other witness recollections. It was not a 10 to 12 foot object, he recalled. It was small, about the size of two suitcases, so just a really big butt plug. But Jerry Betters, a Pittsburgh jazz vocalist who died in 2007, told investigators it was larger than that. Because, you know, nothing goes over better than the gospel word of a jazz vocalist. Anyway. He said the military truck was carrying it and it had a white star on the door. He drew a picture of it and had it notarized. Whatever it was, it wasn't in Kecksburg very long. And where it went, nobody who is talking knows for sure. Most investigators believe that it was taken to a hangar at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, where one witness claims to have seen what appeared to be a small body on the gurney next to it. There's always fucking bodies. Anyway. The witness told Mr. Gordon that there was an arm hanging down. It had three digits and lizard-like skin, Mr. Gordon said he was told. I fucking told you it was the lizard people Illuminati. Darcy didn't believe me. Darcy didn't believe me at all. Mr. Venture is skeptical. Personally, I'm rooting for the UFO evidence since I'm with the Mutual UFO Network, he said. Yeah, no shit. But I really have to say that we have an extremely good theory that this was a spy satellite. And this just keeps going and going. So I'm just going to stop it here because I think we've made our point as to what this thing probably was. So getting back to Shag Harbor, we're going to look at some things as far as this craft goes as to what it's definitely not. First of all, this thing is definitely not flares. This type of theory is usually cast up when people talk about UFO sightings, especially in maritime environments, because ships, and especially because of Captain Mercy's testimony, he said that there was a lot of military goings-on in the area. So a lot of people have said, oh, it's just flares. It's just the flares. Well, here's the thing, is that this thing was witnessed by a lot of people. A lot of people who happened to have spent their entire goddamn lives by the ocean. So they're going to know what flares look like, how they behave. So if this particular thing was a flare, these people would know. The second thing is that this is definitely not a hoax, because there is so much eyewitness testimony from so many people, and it lines up. All of the details of this particular craft seem to line up as far as all of these witness statements are concerned. Everybody seems to report the red flashing lights, and in later accounts, there are orange flashing lights after this particular thing has crashed, but while it's in the sky, everyone reports red flashing lights. Most of them report it as a very shiny object or possibly something that is illuminated itself. Now, for all of the people in Shag Harbor, for the 22 different reports that I read through, for all of them to be in on this one particular hoax seems unlikely to me. Also, given that Captain Mercy's DECA radar on his ship picked up this particular object and numerous ones aside from that, there's more evidence to point toward there was actually something in the sky that actually crashed into the harbor than there is to say that there wasn't. So the next thing we're going to look at here is some people say that this was a bolide meteor, like we discussed in one of the last... similar cases. There's one problem with this particular theory, though, is that a meteor does not hang out in the atmosphere for 3 goddamn hours. It doesn't happen. This particular object was sighted for 3 hours in the sky over Quebec and the rest of the eastern seaboard of Canada before this thing actually crashed. Now, if you ever come across a case where a meteor hangs out in the atmosphere for 3 hours before it careens down and crashes into the Earth, I would love to hear that, because that kind of thing has never been recorded. And the next thing that I have written down here, and I'm pretty sure this is a note from Darcy, it says, for legal reasons, it's definitely not the Lizard People Illuminati. That seems like a weird note, but okay. And so, given all of this, I would have to say, with my particular background in looking into atmospheric phenomenon and all this other stuff, it does not seem to be natural in any way, shape, or form. Northern Lights, Aurora Borealis, light pillars, things like that are common in UFO sightings in Canada, they don't crash. They don't fall into the water. They don't make an audible splash. These things are strictly atmospheric phenomenon, and like we discussed earlier, it's not a meteor. So I would have to say, in my own, and I'm the skeptic here, don't get me wrong, but I have to say that this is definitely not something that is a natural phenomenon that happened. So that leaves the question of what the hell was this thing? So I have a couple of theories, one of which, of course, is an experimental aircraft. Now, in the course of my research, as far as experimental aircraft goes, I did come across a Canadian and American joint venture. This was in conjunction with Avro Technologies and Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. This was known as the VZ-9 Avro car, and it was part of what was called Project 1794. Now, the Avro VZ-9 Avro car was a VTOL aircraft developed by Avro and Lockheed Martin as part of a secret U.S. military project carried out in the early stages of the Cold War. The Avro car intended to exploit the Kononda effect to provide lift and thrust from a single turbo rotor blowing exhaust out of the rim of a disc-shaped aircraft in the air, and it would have resembled a flying saucer. Now, this particular program was retired, supposedly, in 1961, 6 years before this particular incident took place. Now, one can assume, or at least one can speculate, that maybe the Canadian military didn't give up on this. Maybe the United States didn't either. Maybe they developed this technology into something else, but it still wasn't very effective, and therefore it crashed. But who's to say? I mean, the next thing that I have up here is a experimental space probe, and I wrote that down actually before I started looking into the Kecksburg UFO incident that I was reading about earlier, where they said that was possibly a space capsule that was experimental that came crashing down. Now, the thing is, like, Kecksburg happened in 1965, and that was 2 years before Shag Harbor. So the timeline kind of adds up there. If the United States military or the United States space program is already shooting up experimental space capsules, then it's not unlikely that this particular object could have been that. I mean, when you think about the yellow sulfurous foam that they found on the surface of the water, that could have been, like, I'm not a chemist, so if anybody knows anything about this, the chemistry of, say, rocket fuel, please let me know. Send me an email, spiritinstitutegp@gmail.com. It could have been possibly the leftover remnants of rocket fuel mixing with seawater. At least that's my current working theory. That's something that I haven't quite looked into yet, however. But as it stands right now, we still don't know what this thing is, and we probably never will, because this was probably classified Cold War technology that either the records simply will never be declassified or, let's face it, possibly destroyed by this point. Because anybody knows that the Cold War was a time where secrets were held very close, and they weren't always necessarily shared with the public readily. Hell, there's stuff that's coming out now that had been secret since the beginning of the Cold War in the 1950s. So it's kind of unlikely that we are going to have any answers on this anytime soon. However, when I think about it, it's very possible that this was in fact a piece of Cold War technology that got scrapped, because if you remember from the previous episode, the United States military, or the United States Navy, I suppose, arrived extremely quickly to the shores and was very, we'll say, not so nice to the locals that lived there, and were very ruthless in trying to recover this particular object. So I wouldn't put it past them to be essentially looking out for more of their military secrets than giving a shit about what Canadians think. Some things never change. But holy shit, I have been ranting for 30 minutes straight now. Which I think is actually a great point to take a break, because Canadian Spirit is proud to announce that we have our first political sponsor. We'll be back right after this.
Canada, the true north, strong and free. Or at least it was.
You know, this administration is a rabid dog, and it's turning us upside down. And all, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's as obvious as the nose on your face.
In these uncertain times, we need a leader who will fit this country.
Like a glove.
We need a leader who is a winner, not a...
Le who? The her.
A man who has passion.
I love people in this country. I love the heartland of this country.
A man with strong political sense.
It's become obvious that the choice was a bad one. We just need to change it.
So this next election cycle, whenever the fuck that is, vote Jim Carrey for Prime Minister of Canada. Make Canada.
Alrighty then!
This ad is entirely fake. It has been fabricated by the Supernatural Paranormal Investigations and Research Institute, and especially by Kelly McMillan, who insists on turning this into a long-running joke.
Did you guys like that? I'm sure you like that. Anyway, that's pretty much my thoughts on the Shag Harbor UFO crash, and I'm going to go and I'm going to see if I can track down where those men in black suits took Darcy, and he's probably on some kind of Mormon compound somewhere, but we'll be back in 2 weeks, and until then, I've been Kelly, and this has been Canadian Spirit.
That's all for this episode. Special thanks to Torin for our music, Zach Black,
that's me,
for voice work, all of our sources we used for this episode, and you, our listeners. For more information on the Supernatural Paranormal Investigations and Research Institute, visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/SpiritGP. We'll see you in 2 weeks.